Welcome back to Section. My name is Siddharth, I go by Sid, and today we're going to be doing a bit of JavaScript and MySQL so that you can finish our project tour and implement those features. Before we start off, I wanted to do a little something fun. Last Monday, GeoCities closed down. I don't know how many of you are familiar with GeoCities, but they were a free host back when I was in fifth grade, and you could create websites and they would host it for you. And back then it was really cool. Like David was talking about today, you roll over a picture and it changes, right? And for me, my favorite tag was a marquee tag, which basically had a text scroll. And so I wanted to show you all this tribute that XKCD had for, sadly, this is exactly how, very close to how most websites with GeoCities look. A lot of flashy backgrounds and like the table and bad Ahrefs, like the unclosed links. And with, out of 5 pages in my website, 3 pages had under construction. And they've managed to recover a bunch of under construction GIFs from the lost GeoCities websites, but just goes to show what all you can do with HTML. And anyway, back to project 2. So today's going to be a little bit of JavaScript. I'm going to introduce you to JavaScript, see how that goes. And then the most important, the biggest use of JavaScript this week is going to be just validating user input, client-side validation of as the user types in values and forms. So to begin with, JavaScript. We've seen what JavaScript is in lecture today. It is a scripting language that is, scripting language, so it's not compiled, but in the latest set of browser wars, Opera and a bunch of other browsers are now compiling JavaScript, which makes them much faster. But JavaScript is a scripting language, much like, for those who've seen C, it'll look a lot familiar to you. So I think the best way to do is just like start with an example. So the most, can everybody read that? Yeah, okay, great. So the alert box, I don't know, I haven't seen anybody use this in a while, but perhaps the most distinguishable feature of JavaScript is the alert box, and let's take a look at the source. So much like we did CSS, when we had CSS, we had our CSS script, CSS style sheets, style internal and external, included in the head part of the code. Much like that, we have the script tag, which opens, let me actually zoom in so that you can see that. The script tag, which encloses any JavaScript you have, so that basically tells the browser, oh, here comes some JavaScript, look out for it, and parse it accordingly. And I call this function annoy because I made this up at 3 a.m. last night, and I thought it was really funny. But annoy basically throws an alert box, and here is the more interesting part. So it says body on load equals annoy. So sounds like English when the body loads. So when the browser gets the body tag and loads it, it automatically calls this function and it throws that alert box. So which is why when we hit when we go on the page, it throws that alert. Not very useful. So let's take a look at example 2. It also does the same thing, but there is a small difference. It basically says it initializes a variable, much like we did in PHP, where variables had the dollar sign in front of them. Excuse me. The annoy variable here is set to true. So I basically initialize a variable, set it to true, just like C, just like PHP. And then I check to see if annoy is true. Kind of redundant, but just to show you how if loops work, if conditions work in JavaScript, it checks to see if annoy equals true. And if it is true, it throws the alert. So this is going to be always true. So keep in mind that here, so while we look at this, also keep in mind that this is going to be run always, right? I'm not calling this is not a function, so I'm not calling this function. This is always going to be run, and it always is going to look for the variable and then throw that alert. If you want to, what you will probably do in project 2 is to make small functions that validate these, then call them when something happens. We'll see more examples of those, and let's take a look at example 3. So do you want me to annoy you? I'm going to hit yes and hit annoy. And it says, oh, too bad. Okay, I guess I didn't hard code. I'm going to do the small yes. And it says the same thing. Anything other than the small yes, it says, too bad, I'm still going to annoy you, right? This is a little more interesting because it's not always doing that. It waits for me to do something and then looks it up. In the very same way, we have setup, which looks like, setup, which starts and it basically gets an element by ID annoy. So when we use CSS, when we created divs and spans, we had IDs for each div and span. We said ID equals something, and then in our CSS we said something body.id, body.whatever ID, and then we defined a set of CSS properties. The other big use of IDs in classes and spans and IDs and names in general is JavaScript can grab an element using those values. So here we say get element by ID, annoy. IDs are unique, so you can't have multiple IDs in a given page. And what is the only element with the ID annoy here? What is this? It's a text box. It's a text field. I've given an ID annoy, and it says, give me that field. And then that, it says focus. Focus is a method that basically puts the cursor on your on the text box. So when I go on Google.com, for instance, the cursor is on the text box when I go on the page. And this is what is expected of you in Project 2. If you've read through the specs, you will remember that. There are a bunch of requirements which say when you go on a page or when you do something, your page has to focus back on a text box. So it is as simple as saying, where is the page source? It's as simple as saying get element by ID dot focus. The second part is another function. So the function form is usually this. We write a function, we close it. The next function is kind of the same thing, but here we say we're actually grabbing a value from the HTML. So far, do you have any questions? It's going to get a little more intricate, but I don't think it'll be too hard. But the second one, we say annoy equals get document. Document is one of those things that comes free when you initialize this in JavaScript. It's the document off. The document is obviously your page. And you say document.getElementById. So that element in your document, which has the ID, whatever, dot value. So here, in this case, is a text box. So what is the value? For any given text box, the value is whatever is inside the text box. So it's not the name. The name is what you can use to call it. But here, we're sticking with IDs. And you say ID of dot value, so it gives me a text. It grabs a text box and it says, "Give me the value that's in that text box," and it initializes this variable annoy to that. And then it says, "If annoy equals yes, throw this alert; else, throw a different alert." Questions? The if else is again just like C or PHP or any most other languages you've probably seen. Example 4.html. This is from the W3 School's tutorial on JavaScript. It is a great tutorial and has tons of examples. I actually can pull it up right here. It has all these examples here of different just like document objects. The document objects is like document.aValue. Events when a mouse button is clicked, what happens? Do something else, or a bunch of other examples, which you can definitely take a look and see if you want to use, and somehow or the other in your project too. So this says if the time in your browser is less than 10, you will get a good morning. How do we do this? So var d once again initializing a variable to new date. So date is some object, and we initialize a new object of that sort. And this object comes with this method get hours, which is basically gives you the hour on your system clock. So if it's less than 10, it's going to save whatever the value is. And then I'm checking to see if that variable is less than 10. If it is, I write good morning, else I don't. Questions about this? Great. So there are a bunch of classes like these, objects like these, which you can look up and check to see if you want to use them. Do you have a question? I'm sorry. Great. So the other thing that I don't know how many of you have been on websites where when you hit the right click, it throws an alert. It says you can't right click on this website. For instance, a lot of photo storing websites do that to prevent you from stealing images, basically. Remember that JavaScript is enabled in your browser. It's all client-side, so it's on the computer of the person who goes on the website. So you can actually disable JavaScript and go back on the same page and right-click and They probably have other methods, but it will at least stop it from annoying you with alerts. But keep in mind, with any kind of sort of validation, it's not sufficient. There's a great thread on this on the bulletin board. I suggest you take a look at it before you start writing out code for your project. But keep in mind that any client-side validation can be overcome by simply turning off JavaScript on your browser. So regardless of whether you're checking for client-side validation or not, you have to, in your PHP, check to make sure that the values you expect are the values you get. Questions? Great. There are no questions today. yeah.
How can you detect whether JavaScript is disabled?
How can you detect if JavaScript is disabled? I believe there is a class. You can actually check. Here we go. So, okay, this is not what we need, but in general, I'm guessing. I don't know if you can look it up, because if you have to look it up with JavaScript, you can't, because JavaScript is not enabled. But I'm guessing you can't. But either way, I kind of see why you're asking this, because if you can't turn it off, why do the checks at all? It just makes it a lot faster, and you don't have to make requests to the website to and come back with an error every time. Any other questions? Okay, so. This is I like this demo, because I can click on a button and it changes the color of the text. I can do this again and again, and it's not much. It's just some CSS and JavaScript together. So I have two functions here. One is called change to red, and one is called change to blue. I could factor this into one function and give it an argument, which I will do in a couple of demos later. But basically, I have a div that I've created here called color div, right? I've created a div called color div, and I open a form. I've called a form 1. I don't need a form there. I don't have to name it anything at all. But I have two buttons there, one of which can on click does the change to red function, and the other one changes to blue. Excuse me. How does this work? I have document.getElementById, so it gives me that ID which has color div, which is my div itself. It has some random text in it. It doesn't matter what is in it. It can be text, can be h1 tags, any form of HTML. That div contains some HTML. It gives me back that HTML, and it says that HTML style.color. It's much like CSS, where in CSS we said style equals, and we defined the div, and we wrote out the name of the div, and we initialized those values to whatever we wanted them to be. Here I'm saying style.color equals red, or style.color equals blue, and when I click it, it changes color. Questions? Great. Before we go into more JavaScript, I thought I'll just quickly run through lock tables and unlock tables, because why do we have lock and unlock tables? So that multiple transactions don't take place at the same time. As I mentioned in the section a few weeks ago, if there are two ATMs, which is pretty much what you're doing here, you have one account, and if a person logs in from two different computers and hits buy with all the money he has on both computers at the same time, what is to say that you're not going to let both transactions get through? You don't want that to happen, obviously, and it's hard to do that, but it is possible. So what do locks in MySQL do? They take a table, they lock it, let you perform a bunch of operations, and then unlock it when you're done, so that no other operations can be done during that. In this way, you know that while you're doing some calculations, while you're making some changes here, and giving it back a new value, nobody else has come in and grabbed some money from that account and bought shares. So what is this syntax? The reason I didn't write out specific examples for this is I want to gradually transition into letting you find examples, but I'll run you through this. There's going to be lock tables, which makes sense. So actually, let's take a look at example directly. Take a look at these queries right here. So start with an easier one. Right. So here it says lock tables T1 read. So what does this do? It says, lock these tables, let me only read from it, because I don't want to write. I don't want to let anybody else change any values or update it or insert any new values. So I'm going to lock table T1. This is very much like when we open a file. In PHP, we said fopen name of file, comma, WR or RW, which basically said, Let me read it, let me write it, or let me do both at the same time. So here we're saying lock table C1 read, which means the table is locked, and it's gonna let you read. And then you're saying select star from T1. T1 can be account star from T1, which basically says, give me the number of records in that table. T1 can be any table. In your case, it's going to be stocks, portfolio, whatever. And then it says, it's going to display that value. And then you can select another value from T2, but T2 here is not, I'm guessing it's in context with this example. But once you're done reading these, all you have to do is call the unlock tables comment query here. And once you call that query, it's going to unlock that table and let you do other operations on it. Sorry?
Can the person still write?
No. No. You can only read. Yeah, the read is... Right. I'm sorry again. So, any other questions on it?
If you're using an NLDB database, mm-hmm. then use transaction statements where you
yes.
start transactions.
Yeah, I'm not familiar with the syntax, but yes, that's how you go about it. Mm-hmm.
And you can use that with the MySQL query function.
I'm not sure. I've never used an NLDB, so I'm not sure. But I can look that up.
If you lock the table as one user and another user comes in, mm-hmm. basically the other user can have to wait.
Yes.
If for any reason you're locking the table and it's a longer update for some mm-hmm. reason, then you
yeah, they're going to wait until we are done with the operation.
So you could end up waiting for a minute.
Right. Yeah, possibly. Yes. Which is fine, because the trade-off here is either waiting or losing, like having changes that you don't know about, right?
Well, that's as opposed to using the other.
Right. The you know. Right. Right.
You won't have that.
Right.
Permission.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Do you have a question?
Yeah.
Ah, yeah.
Can you use some guidelines as to when to use locking versus transactions?
I've never used transactions, so I always lock the table, carry out a bunch of operations, and then unlock it, which I think that is what the specs need here. I think the specs just ask for...
specs what you're using the lock or a column.
I mean, I've never used transactions, so I can't tell you right now, but I can... look it up if you want.
I have used the transactions, and basically you just start the transaction with a command start transaction, mm-hmm. and you go through the whole transaction.
Right.
And then you should double check that when you're all done, everything is what you want, and if everything is what you want, then you can commit.
Right. So he says, just for people at home, you start a transaction, you list a bunch of queries, and then you check to see that the values are still what you expected it to be, and then carry out all of them at the same time if you're ready. Is that right?
I should have just one thing: is before I do the start transaction, I calculate what I'm expecting to be the final values, mm-hmm. so that
you know that nothing has changed
before
over.
Before you can start, and then it's
right. Yeah.
If we're only performing like one operation on a table, do we still need to lock it? Like if we were just updating one value in one row, should we still lock it?
Should we still be locking if we're doing one operation? In this case, most of our operations are going to be just like single line one, right? It's going to read a query, you're going to read a row and then write it on. But the idea is to just get you used to locking and unlocking tables. So yes, in this case, yes.
So we should lock every time, for every MySQL?
So you don't lock for every MySQL query. You want to lock where you're reading a value, and then based on that value, you're making changes to the table. Because then if you've read this value and then the value changes, the changes you make are not the changes you want it to be. So it's always in that context that you want to lock and unlock tables. Yeah.
So I'm confused as to when you unlock the table. I guess you have to unlock it before you're about to change something.
Right.
I mean,
right.
So you lock it and then you read.
And then, right, right.
Whatever you're going to read and then.
And then write it.
When you unlock
right.
it.
Right. You can write back onto it. And,
okay. And when you unlock it and you. Do your command, I mean, who's to say that the other person...
No, so, okay, so here, so you read the value, and then you make changes. So here, if you take a look at this, for instance, mm-hmm. It says lock. Actually, this is the example. Is there another question about the first one, or shall I go into this? Yeah.
The PHP, I just wanted to ask about the multiple statements. Can we pass it in one string?
Can you pass multiple statements? Yes, it's possible. You can undertake multiple strings, but they will be carried out in one bound. Yeah. Yeah. Other questions? Yeah, so let's take a look at this example. So here you lock a table T. So here you lock the table here to write, and here locks create aliases. So you can call a table a different name and lock that section. So you can call a table and write this T is T1, basically creates an alias T1 that you can read from. And here, when you try to insert into T select star from T, you can't do this because T is not locked to read. So you have to read from T1 and write into T2. I've read through this tutorial and it feels fairly clear, and maybe this is because the examples they give are really nice. But I suggest you like look through the examples and try to figure out if you can work that out. This is also in view of that. The locking is, in this case, is kind of unnecessary because you're taking one operation and inserting another value. But if you read through this, the examples are great and it'll probably make a lot more sense. And definitely email help CS75 if you have questions with that. Let's see. So the most use of JavaScript you will have in this project is to validate input, like I said. So if a user has a bunch of values in a form and hits submit, you are going to check in your PHP like you did for project one to see if, for instance, if the price was negative or the quantity was negative. If the quantity was negative, you threw back an error on the page saying, hey, I cannot accept a negative quantity. But in PHP, in JavaScript, it's essentially what we're going to do, let's take a look at this. I'm going to first hit add. This is presumably something similar to what you will have in your setup, where you will be submitting to a form using some button, and you have a student name, email, school. Here it's just a bunch of text fields, and I hit add without filling in any of my queries, so it says please type a name. I hit OK, and it's so let's type in a name and hit again. It says please include an email address, so I'm going to do something. And I'm going to hit add again, and the same error again, so I'm going to throw a school name, and it says, okay, great, so it works. Let's take a look at the source of this. Here it's PHP, so let's begin with this function. So first let's take a look at the HTML. So it's a form, it's just like the ones we've seen. It says on submit, which is another event, so you wait for something to submit. And on submit, you return this function, which means it will run this function when you click the submit button in your form. The check submission function here has the following checks. So it says if document.myform.student.value. So let's take a look at how my HTML is laid out. So I have my document, which comes with every JavaScript method. So you have the document by itself. I have a form here called myForm. So when I say document.myForm, I'm referring to document.thisForm. And I have another which says .student. So if you here I have ID equals student. I'm sorry, name equals student is what I want here. So I have name equals student, and then I have a break, which is just normal HTML. So when you take a look at this, it says document.myForm.student.value. So value, once again, is going to give me that object's value. So whatever is stored in that text field, if that is equal to zero, I throw an alert which says, please type a name, and then what do? I return false, which is why it checks the first thing, and then it returns false. It doesn't bother looking for the other two fields. So when I filled out the first one, when it checked that, it didn't return false, and in the next one it said, oh, here's an error, so I'm going to return false again. So this is probably a check that most of you will be doing in your project too, to make sure none of the fields are empty. And it's so on for all three fields. So I have email, and then it throws the correct alert. And then the school name, which again throws an alert and exists. If all of them pass, I return true. Which is why when I hit all three, I can even give it a single character. It's not checking for anything more. It's just checking to see if something has a value and it returns true. Let's take a look at this one. So I hit add. Please include an email address. So I'm going to hit add. Please include a school name. Take a look at what is different here. So here it says, there's just one line of code here. It says document.myform.student.focus. So once again, focus is what we use to bring it back to the form once we've run through the code. So it says document.myform. So I've looked through my form. So I have my document. I'm grabbing the myform element from it, grabbing the email or the name or whichever student element from it, and I'm saying .focus. So it'll put the cursor in that text field for me. So when I go on validation2.php and I hit SID and I hit add, it says OK, and then it focuses that it focuses back onto that text field. Any questions at this point? Great. Validation 3, so I'm going to hit, let's start with no field, I'm going to hit add. Oh, now it changes color to red, much like the first example we saw, one of the first examples we saw. What is it going to do? So the first thing it's going to do is to check to see if it's empty. If it is empty, focus it and also change the color of that part to red. Let's take a look at the source. So function check submission. It says, if document.myform.student.value, by now you should be fairly comfortable with this, go from the document to any given element in your document, myform.student.value is equal to 0, I'm going to say get element, oops, I'm sorry, I'm going to say document.getElement by ID student span. I didn't have this the last time, so let's just take a look at what I did with my HTML here. I have span ID equals student span. I've just added that around every text field that all the text that I had in my first one. The first one is span ID equals student span. I have just student name, the text student name there. So any changes I make to this span student span is going to be reflected in that text within it. And then there's the text field, which is the same. And so when I go back here, it says get element by ID, student span. So it's going to give me that span, and it's going to change the color. It's going to change the style of the span dot color. So it's going to change the color property of the style of the span to red, and then focus it back onto that because clearly I didn't fill it out, and I need to, and return false. So when I go on this and I hit SID, I'm going to do my email, and it goes to the next one and focuses it. And when I hit add, all's good. Questions? Great. So validation 4, we're going to step it up a little bit. So I'm going to try entering my name and hitting add. And now it not only did it do the other, just that one, but it also filled out both of them after that. So if I'd actually not filled out my name at all and I'd hit add, it would have basically changed all of them to the same value. Let's see, view page source. So this is a neat trick. So I create this variable called user input. So var user input, and I'm setting it to true initially. Once I find that one of my text fields are empty, I'm going to change this flag to say false. And once I know this is false, what do I know? I know that at least one of my fields has already been false. So I'm going to change it the first time, and then using this flag, I'm going to decide whether I want to change the color to red or not. So in my first case, I said, if document.myformStudentValue, I change the color to red, which makes sense because it's empty, and then I'm saying user input equals false. But this is basically a flag that says, oh wait, there has been an error already. The user not entered something here. So when I go to the next step, I'm going to check to see if, I'm first going to change this to red, and then if the user input exists, so if the user input is true, this is nothing but the short form for if user input equals true. If that is true, I should not focus it. If it is true, I want to focus it because none of the other errors have already happened. But if there has been an error before me, I'm going to set that one to focus on and not these. So once I know that this value is false, I'm not going to bother focusing it because I've already focused it on some other element up there. If that is true, I want to do it and set it to false. Same for that. So when I go here and I say, when I say sit and I hit add, this is like a useful, I didn't know that I've done that, but this is a useful thing. So when you're setting something to false in the beginning, when you're changing the color, when the next time around the page, when you hit add again, you should check to make sure that if that value is correct now, you want to remove that coloring, which I clearly didn't do. And so even when my value was right, I hit add, the student name change stayed red. And so here, if I have that and I hit add, it just focuses on the very first field, simply because at that point, my user input is unchanged and is true. Questions? Great. So in a form, if you have a bunch of text fields of which you know the first one is false, you want to focus there and leave the rest alone. So this is the way you'd go about it if you want to make sure all the checks are done. Let's go to example 5. This one's a little interesting. So I'm going to go back and hit this, and I'm going to first hit add, and still the same problem. So I'm going to enter my user ID, and I'm going to put down school. I'm going to hit add. But now it comes back to this and says, wait, your email has something in it, but clearly it is not an email address. It's just like a bunch of, it's a string. It's a bunch of letters. I want you to give me an actual email address. So how would you go about doing it? One way to do it would be to use the match function. The other is, I think, more common, using a regular expression, of which we call regex for a regular expression. So what does this say? Regular expression that. And then it says, we'll come back to what that means in a second, but in my email, not only am I checking to see that, I'm also checking to see if regex.test, so if this variable, when it tests whatever string I have, if that does not return true, which means my email address failed this test that I'm passing when I'm calling on regex, show get an error message in and show it. So let's take a look at, let's try to enter a normal email address. So I'm going to enter a normal email address, hit add, and it worked fine. So it reloaded the page, which means it worked fine. But how exactly does this string right here, this regex, how did I come about it? This is a useful trick because regexes are usually common in most languages, and it's good to know how to work with them. So for any given language, I take that back. For most languages, patterns are placed between these two slashes. So if I have a pattern here, and this is how I denote that this given expression is a regular expression. What does this say? So it says dot plus at dot plus, right? This basically means the dot is used for characters, and I'm saying plus. So let's just break this down, actually. Dot plus. Is this my regex? Where is my regex? Yep. So I actually don't need this plus here because I could use it. So here it basically says there's something here, and then there's something here, right? So let's just go back to this for a second and try to. Let me show you why this thing also fails, because I can say that worked. So clearly my email regex right now is invalid, but it does something, and let's see what that is. So this basically denotes the pattern that you have. Anything that goes within it is going to be specified by the pattern. Here you have a dot plus and at any dot plus. So the first thing, let's break this down into literals and the actual expressions. This is a literal, which means I want to match this to at and at only. I want to match this. I want to see if this at exists in the middle of the string. The dot plus, on the other hand, says dot is any character. It says if there is at least one. So any given, so if I have a plus, this represents the string AA. It also represents the string AAA. It can represent any number of strings. It can represent that string, but it has to have at least one A. So it says, is there a character? Is there at least one character? Is there an at after it? And is there at least one character after that? And with that, it closes the pattern and it says, when I match this with any given string, so in this case it was foo at bar, does this work? Yes, because this satisfies this portion, the at symbol satisfies this at, and the bar is satisfied by that. Questions? Okay, so let's just do a couple of examples here, just to get us used to it. Right. So, which is the first example I have is this. A-N-B-C. Right? So, this checks to see. This is basically, it's one character right here. So this has to have one character. And it checks to see if this symbol right here says, check to see if there is a character outside of the following two symbols. So this does not accept ABC, because this fits in the category where the first letter is A, and it does not accept NBC, but it does accept BBC and any other letter outside these two. Does it make sense? There is an exhaustive list of JavaScript regexes. Let's see. There's an exhaustive list right here. I will link to this on the resources website or under my section notes. It's just a useful thing to know, because you don't have to bother like checking. You don't have to like look up regexes every time you want to write out a string. All you have to do is figure out a bunch of ways you can denote different strings, and you can match alphanumeric characters. You can match single digit characters or any of those. All of them just given by the placeholder slash, and then once it sees a slash, it's going to say, oh, here comes a regex, and close the slash, it says, here's the pattern I want to match. Questions? Great. Have one more example. Let's go back to validation 6. So first, that doesn't work. Great, so I'm going to try that and hit Harvard and see if it adds. Doesn't work, so I'm going to try that. Doesn't works. Let's go back here. Let's see what I'm doing here. So let's see. Did okay. So my bad. It looks like I did not copy the latest form of the regex, but I will. The section notes will have them updated so that you can look at the actual regex for any given email. And in fact, use it in your code if you want to. A couple of more examples I have here are from the W3 Schools website. First one is that of an event. So outside the normal, when I click a button, check to see if some value is full or not. Check to see if some value matches is what I expect it to be. Outside those, you can also have events in your page. So when I go on this page and I click, it says you'll click the left mouse button. When I click my double click, says you click the right mouse button. So it's really cool, because it's giving you values which you otherwise cannot access using PHP. How does this work? This is also a really good example of how to pass a function an argument. Once again, like C, like most other languages you've seen. So it says it has a function called whichButton that takes one argument called event. And the event here is on mouse down. So in my body, so which means it's always going to be listening for this event. So once I load the page, it's going to say, it's consistently going to wait to see if there's a click. The moment there's a click, it's going to call whatever the function I assign it to call. Here, the event here is on mouse down, and it says on mouse down equals which button dot event. So it's basically calling that function as soon as it sees a click. And what is the event here? It's the click itself. So the event has its own properties. And one of the properties here for the mouse down event is the button property. So it says event.button equals 2 is the right. So the 2 is denoted by the right mouse button, and the 1 is denoted by the left one. So it says if event, which is the argument that I've passed it, if that button equals 2, which means I've clicked the right mouse, throw an alert, else throw another alert. Yep.
So is event an object that occurs
once
the...
Yes. Event is not
an object that is being passed.
Right. It is an object that's right. So the question was, is event an object that's being passed? Yes, it's being passed to this, and it has its own set of properties, which one of which is button.
When you click your right click, the result is always two.
I'm sorry?
When you click on the right click, the result is always two.
Yes, so this object is defined such that the event.button is set to 2 if my click is right, if it's my right click, set to 1 if it's my left click. So here it says, so for instance, now I click the, now that worked. There we go. When I right click it, it says, you click the right mouse button because that event, when passed as an argument to this method, sets the button to 2. Any other questions? I'm going to be sticking around for, that's all I have today. I'm going to be sticking around for a bit, so do swing by if you have questions.